You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Welcome, everybody. Welcome to Curiosity Invited. My name is David Bryan, and today I have the distinct pleasure of speaking with Daryl Davis. He's the person on the screen whose mouth is not moving as I'm speaking. It's interesting. Daryl is an incredibly interesting fellow. He is, by training, by profession, by talent, by all sorts of things, an incredibly talented musician who has been, okay, but that is not why you are most well known. He has, over the years, what's interesting, you know, I've read that you've gotten clan members to give up their robes, but it doesn't sound like that's your mission. Like, you haven't been on a mission to collect clan members' robes and get them to give it up. It's like you're not trying to convince them.
You are correct. And I'm glad you point that out, because unlike, you know, most media, you know, if you Google my name, it'll say, you know, black musician converts X number of KKK members or whatever.
Yes.
No, exactly. I did not convert anybody. I am the impetus, if you will, for over 200 white supremacists, Ku Klux Klan members, neo-Nazis, and others, other racists, to renounce that ideology. And in doing so, many of the KKK members have given me their robes and hoods. Some of them now come out with me and speak on my stage when I give lectures, renouncing that movement, their former movement, and working towards de-radicalizing people still in the movement, mm-hmm. as well as working towards preventing young people, especially, from joining these movements.
Okay. But it sounds like it started in some abstract way when you were a young person, when you were 10, you were a kid.
But to understand that profound effect, we have to go back before I was age 10. I grew up as the child of parents in the U.S. Foreign Service. So I grew up as an American embassy kid, mm-hmm. and I began traveling abroad to different countries at the age of 3 in 1961. I'm 64 years old now, born in 58.
You're a baby.
Yeah, exactly. And you know how it works is you get assigned to a country for 2 years, and then you come back home at the end of those 2 years, back here to the States. You may be here for a few months, you may be here for a year, and then you're sent back overseas to another foreign country. So back and forth every 2 years, I would travel starting at the age of 3. And my first exposure to school was overseas. Yeah, my classmates were from Nigeria, Japan, Russia, France, Germany, Italy, you know, you name it. Those were my classmates. And because that was my first exposure to school, that was my baseline for what school should be. That was my norm. Mm-hmm. But every time I'd come back home here to my own country, I would either be in all black or black and white schools, meaning the still segregated or the newly integrated. So having that kind of background, you know, we all got along. We didn't judge each other on color. We played together. We worked together. We had slumber parties together. You name it. Color was not a thing that we talked about.
Yeah.
Okay, so age 10, I come back, I'm in a integrated school, but there were only two black kids in the entire school. myself in fourth grade and a little black girl in second grade. Now, I have brought you my fourth grade picture. See if you can find me, okay?
Wait, let me guess.
Okay, so you see me, that's me at age 10. All right, so now that was one of the first U.S. schools that I went to that was integrated. All the other ones were, you know, were all black, you know, that I was allowed to go to, right? Okay, so now you see some of the guys there in the back row with me.
Yeah.
Some of them were members of the Cub Scouts. And they invited me to join the Cub Scouts. This is 1968. And so I joined the Cub Scouts, sounded like fun. You know, you get to tie knots, go camping, and all that kind of thing. And so I joined the Cub Scouts. Well, we had a parade, and it was the Cub Scouts, Boy Scouts, Brownies, Girl Scouts, 4-H Club, and a bunch of different organizations. And we were marching from Lexington to Concord, Massachusetts, to commemorate the ride of Paul Revere.
Right.
So the streets are all blocked off. The sidewalks on either side are lined with nothing but white people. And they're all, you know, waving and cheering and yelling, the British are coming and all that kind of thing. And until we got, you know, everything was fine. Everybody's having a good time. And until we got to a certain point on the parade route, when suddenly I was getting hit with bottles and soda pop cans and just small debris from the street by only a small group of the spectators on the sidewalk to my right. My scout leaders, my den mother, my cub master, my troop leader, all came running over. These are all white people, right? They all came running over and huddled around me and quickly escorted me out of the danger. Now, you know, when I first got hit, of course, you know, I'm looking to see, you know, what's happening. And I see people, you know, throwing things. My first thought was, oh, these people over here, they don't like the scouts. That's how naive I was, because, you know, I had no precedent for this behavior.
Sure.
And I had no idea why they were doing this. It wasn't until those troop leaders, scout leaders, came running over and huddled over me that I realized I was the only scout getting this special protection. So now I'm wondering, what did I do? What did I do to those people to cause them to do something?
You did not at that moment know.
No.
This has something to do with my color.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
That's why.
You know?
Yeah.
And so after the parade was over, you know, we went back to the meeting place and I went home. And my mom and dad, who were not at the parade, they're cleaning me up, bandaging me up.
Yeah.
And they're asking me, how did you fall down and get all scraped up? You know, they thought I tripped and fell or something. And I told them exactly what had happened. So now, to your point, for the first time in my life, my mom and dad sat me down and explained to me what racism was. David, at the age of 10, I had never heard the word racism. I had no clue what they were talking about. No clue. Okay? It just was not in my vocabulary. It was not in my sphere. It was not in my world.
You know, Daryl, I've got chills going right now. But the reason is, I mean, that's a terrible story. I have such a similar story. It wasn't Cub Scouts. I was in elementary school, and I actually think it was an entirely white, in Ridgewood, New Jersey. I'll never forget it. Entirely white school, elementary school, you know, whatever. Had my friends. And one day I was walking down the stairs in the hallway and other people walking up, and I accidentally bumped into, I'll never forget the kid's name, Mike Decker, who was a friend of mine. And a white kid, and his books dropped. And he turned to me and he said, "You dirty Jew." And I'm Jewish. And and I remember going home, and I said, "I'm sorry," whatever. And I remember going home and being incredibly confused and asking my mom, why would somebody say, I didn't, first of all, it never occurred to me, like, how did he know I was Jewish?
How did he know you were dirty?
I didn't know what he was. So like, why would somebody say dirty Jew? Like, I didn't get it. And my parents that night, it was the conversation for the first time I remember. I must have been 7 or 8. It was the first time I remember a conversation about you're Jewish and there are people who won't like you because of that. And that's so chilling. So anyway, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to stop your story there.
No. Hey, that's a great story. And we learn from that.
Yeah.
Awesome. You know, we learn from that going forward. You know, in your case, in my case, instead of getting furious, we got curious. Curious. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So when my parents, you know, when my parents were telling me this, I'm an only child. So I only had my mom and dad to rely on, you know. And they never lied to me. But on this day, I truly believe that they were lying to me. For whatever reason, they were not telling me the truth. Racism, what the heck is that? You know? My 10-year-old brain could not process the idea that somebody would want to hurt me for no other reason than the color of my skin. It made no sense to me. And furthermore, to my point, the people who were doing that looked just like my friends, whether they were my friends right there in Belmont or my friends overseas. Mm-hmm. So finally, I accepted it that this thing that I never heard of called racism does exist. But what I did not understand was why. And I formed a question in my mind at that age, which was, how can you hate me when you don't even know me? So I got curious instead of furious. And for the next 54 years, I've been looking for the answer to that question. So, you know, who better to ask that question of than someone who would go so far as to join an organization with over 100-year history of practicing hating people who don't look like them, who don't believe as they believe or worship as they worship. Okay, so it was happenstance. Yeah. So after I graduated college, I became a professional musician. And there came a point where country music had made a resurgence. A movie called Urban Cowboy with John Travolta.
Oh, that's right. I remember
that. Yeah, it changed the whole radio and nightclub scene.
Was country music. It was cool.
Yeah, country came back.
Yeah.
And, you know, so if you want to work full time, you know, you played country. So I joined this country band. You know, I like country music. It's no different than the blues. Same three chords.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I was the only black guy in the band. The band was pretty well established. I'm here in Maryland now. I'm from Chicago originally, but I live in Maryland. And the band was pretty established in the Maryland area. I joined them. And they had played a place, all white band, they had played a place up in a town called Frederick, Maryland, about an hour and 20 minutes outside of Washington, D.C., a place called the Silver Dollar Lounge. And the Silver Dollar Lounge was known as an all-white lounge. There were no signs, you know, like you saw back in the day of, you know, colored water fountain, white water fountain, something like, nothing like that. But it had that reputation. And you knew if you were black, you were not welcome there. So, you know, if you go somewhere where you're not welcome and alcohol is being served, it's not always a good combination.
Oh, it's a bad combination. But wait, so by now in your life, by this time in your life, you're no longer naive. You've now had enough incidents in the world.
Some people
bumped into the world.
Some people might correct you and tell you that I'm still naive. I don't think I am, but there are people who tell me that I am. So I have bumped into the world.
Yeah. So you knew what you were getting into as you walked into this bar.
Yes, I did. Yeah. Yes, I did. But I walked in anyway. I mean, hey, you know, so I'm in there and of course I got some looks, but you know, we did our job and after the first set of music, you know, we take a break and I'm walking to the band table with the band when I felt somebody behind me reach over my shoulder and, you know, put their arm around my shoulder. He says, "Man, I sure love your piano playing. This is the first time I ever heard a black man play piano like Jerry Lee Lewis." Well, I had to tell him, you know, where Jerry Lee Lewis, you know, learned how to play. And he didn't believe me. And I said, "Look, man, I know Jerry Lee Lewis personally. He's a good friend of mine. You know, he's told me himself how he used to go and watch these black blues and boogie-woogie piano players play in his hometown of Faraday, Louisiana." Well, he didn't believe that I knew Jerry Lee or anything like that. And so
was he hostile? Or he was
No, he wasn't hostile. He just thought I was BSing him or something.
Yeah.
You know, he just couldn't get it into his head. But he was so fascinated with me that he wanted me to go back to his table with him and let him buy me a drink. He took this glass of whatever he was drinking, and he clinked my glass and cheered me. And then he says, you know, this is the first time I ever sat down with a black man and had a drink. Innocently, I asked him, I said, why? And he didn't answer me. He stared down at the tabletop, didn't say anything. I asked him again, and his buddy sitting next to him elbowed him and said, tell him. And I said, tell me. He looked at me and he said, I'm a member of the Ku Klux Klan. Well, I burst out laughing at him because, as I told you, I have all these books and I've never read anywhere in any of those books how a Klansman will come up, put his arm around a black guy and praise his piano play and want to hang out and talk to him and buy him a drink.
You never read that book?
I missed that book.
Buy a black man a drink.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, that wasn't happening. This guy's pulling my leg. So I'm laughing. He goes into his pocket, pulls out his wallet, goes through it, flips through some cards, pulls out one and gives it to me. It's his Klan membership card. I recognize the Klan logo insignias, which is a red circle with a white cross and a red blood drop in the center of the cross. Oh. Whoa, this thing is for real. So I stopped laughing because it wasn't funny at that point, yes, right?
Suddenly it's really not funny.
Yeah, and so, but I gave him back his card. We talked about the Klan and other things, but the guy gave me his phone number. He wanted me to call him anytime I was to return to this bar with this band, because he wanted to bring his friends, you know, the ones with the pointed hats and robes, Klansmen and Klanswomen, to see, as he put it, the black guy who plays like Jerry Lee. I'm not sure if he called me a black guy to his friends or not, but that's how he explained it to me. And so I'd call him every 6 weeks and say, hey, man, you know, we're going to be down at the Silver Dollar. Come on out. He'd come out and he'd bring Klansmen and Klanswomen. You know, they didn't come in robes and hoods. You know, came in regular street clothes. Right. And they'd gather around near the bandstand and watch me play with the band. They'd get out on the dance floor and dance. And on the breaks, I'd make my way over to his table, say hello. The ones who came with them, most of them, you know, were curious about me. They, you know, they hung by the table, wanted to meet me, talk to me, et cetera. But there were a couple of them that would get up every time they saw me coming and moved to the other side of the room. So, you know, that went on until the end of that year. And then I quit that band and I went on back to playing, you know, rock and roll and whatever else was going on.
Yeah.
And it dawned on me, you know, Daryl, you blew it. The answer to your question that has been plaguing you
was sitting at that table.
Yeah, was right there.
Yeah.
You know, find that guy's number, call him up, you know, and see if he will hook you up with the Klan leader for the state of Maryland. Now, a state leader in the Klan is what's known as, what we would call a state leader, the governor. They call their state leader the Grand Dragon. And anybody prefixed with the word imperial means that person is national. So imperial wizard would be like what we call the president, who oversees all of the states in which he has a chapter of his Klan group. So anyway, this guy named Roger Kelly was the Grand Dragon of Maryland. And I didn't know Mr. Kelly personally, but I knew who he was.
Kelly is not the guy at the table.
No.
Mm-mm. Okay. So, but you wanted to meet him.
I wanted to meet Kelly. The guy at the table was one of Kelly's members.
Yeah.
Okay. So I found the guy's number. You know, this is, you know, a few years later. I called it. It had been disconnected. It took me a couple weeks to track him down. He had moved. He didn't have a phone, but I got an address on him. So I go by his apartment unannounced. I had no way of contacting the guy, right? Let him know how I want to come over and talk to you. So I just show up there one evening and I knock on his door and he opens the door and he's like, whoa, hey, Daryl, what's going on? And he goes, hey, man, you know, are you still playing? What's going on? And I say, yeah, I'm still playing. But listen, I need to talk to you about the Klan. I said, listen, man, do you know Roger Kelly? Yeah, I know Roger. Roger was my Grand Dragon. I said, well, listen, I'm going to write a book on the Klan and I want to interview Roger Kelly. You know, can you hook me up with him? He said, "Darryl, I can't do that. You know, we both will be in trouble." I said, "But you're not in the Klan anymore." He goes, I cannot take a black man to the Grand Dragon." And so I begged and pleaded for Mr. Kelly's information. He finally gave it to me on the condition that I not tell Roger Kelly where I got it.
Where you got it. Yeah.
So I had my secretary
call. By this time, you're really on this mission. I mean, you're going.
Absolutely. 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 Wow. So my secretary, and the only reason I mention her skin color, because I could care less, is that it's part of my story. She's white. So I asked her to call Roger Kelly and ask him if he would consent to sitting down and doing an interview with her boss, because he's writing a book on the Klan. Now, I'm the one who had the number. I could have called him myself. Oh, I forgot to tell you. The guy told me before I left with the address and phone number of Mr. Kelly and him telling me, don't reveal where I got it. He said, "Darryl, do not fool with Roger Kelly. Roger Kelly will kill you." So I also had that in mind. The reason why I did not call him, because I figured, well, if he knew, he might detect in my voice over the phone that I'm black. And he said, "I'm not talking to you, quick." And my project would have ended before it ever got started.
Yeah.
But I knew that if Mary called him, he would know that the other voice on the other end of the phone is a white lady. And I knew enough about the mentality that I would know that he would not assume that this white woman is working for a black man, especially a black man who's writing a book on the Klan. They don't exist, right? So that would up my chances of him agreeing to it. And then if he agreed, obviously, when he saw me, he could figure out my color, right? And then he can decide what he wants to do. So she called him, she got a hold of him, and he agreed to do the interview. He didn't ask what color I was. We set it up for this motel room. In fact, it was the motel right above the Silver Dollar Lounge. Lounge is in the basement of this motel. And so Mary and I got there several hours early and got the room. I gave her some money, sent her down the hall to get soda pop out of the vending machine, put it in the ice bucket, get it all cold. And, I want to be able to offer my guests a cold beverage. And the way the room just happened to be, if you're standing in the hallway, looking through the door into the room, you cannot see who's in the room. You have to walk through the door, turn to your right, go around the corner, and then you see the layout of the room. So I took the lamp off and put the table in the most obscure corner of the room, right? And put a chair on one side for Mr. Kelly, a chair on the other side for me. And I had this little black canvas bag sitting beside my chair, in which I had a cassette recorder, blank cassettes, put the recorder in the middle of the table, all in hopes that A, he would come in and sit down, even knowing that I'm black.
Right.
And two, that he would allow me to record.
Right.
So I'm all prepared, right? Right on time. We set it for 5:15, right at 5:15, knock, knock, knock on the door. I'm seated at the table where you can't see me from the doorway. Mary hops up, runs around the corner, opens the door. In walks what is known as the Grand Nighthawk. Nighthawk means bodyguard. A Grand Nighthawk would be the bodyguard to the Grand Dragon, like an Imperial Nighthawk would be the bodyguard to the Imperial Wizard. All right, so in walks this Grand Nighthawk, and he's wearing military fatigues. Got that red circle, white cross, blood drop patch on one side of his chest, the letters KKK on the other.
Wow.
Embroidered on his cap. It said Knights of the Ku Klux Klan.
Nobody's shy about this.
Yeah, and on his hip, he had a semi-automatic in a holster. And he comes, and comes around the corner, and he sees me and just freezes. Now, Mr. Kelly is on the other side of the corner, right? Doesn't realize that his Nighthawk stopped short. So Mr. Kelly comes around the corner and slams into this guy's back and knocks the guy forward. And now they both are stumbling around, looking all over the room, and I'm just sitting at the table looking at them like, I could read their faces. I could see the apprehension, and I knew what they were thinking.
Yeah,
they
there's got to be some danger somewhere.
Yeah,
right?
Well, they're thinking, yeah. You know, did the desk clerk give us the wrong room number, yeah. Or is this an ambush?
This is an ambush, yeah.
Right, so I stood up, and I went like this to show my palms. I have nothing in my hands, right? And I walked right towards Mr. Kelly with my right hand extended. I said, "Hi, Mr. Kelly, I'm Daryl Davis." And he shook my hand, as did the Nighthawk. So far, so good. I said, please, come on in, have a seat. Mr. Kelly sat down. The Nighthawk stood at attention to his right. But anyway, so we got on into this interview. Well, a little over an hour into this interview, Mr. Kelly and I just talking casually. And out of nowhere, there was a very fast, very short noise, like a that was it, just that. And we all jumped because it was so out of context, we didn't know where it came from. And I jumped up out of my chair and I hit the table. And I knew that Mr. Kelly had made this noise. And because the noise was so short and so fast, it was, you know, here and gone in a second, my ear could not discern what it was. And because I could not identify it, I perceived it to be an ominous, threatening noise. You know, here I am sitting in a hotel room with the head of the Ku Klux Klan for the state of Maryland.
Well, and you also have that guy saying, yeah, he's going to kill, or he would.
Don't fool with him, he'll kill you.
Yeah.
So I got all that going in my head, and I had gone into survival mode.
Yeah.
And I'm looking right at Mr. Kelly. Yeah. And when I hit the table, I'm looking right into his eyes. I didn't say one word, but my eyes were speaking for me, and they were saying to him, "What did you just do?" His eyes were looking right into my eyes, and I could read his eyes. They were asking me the same question.
Yeah,
what did
you
just do? Right. Yeah. And the Nighthawk had his hand back on his gun. You know, he didn't pull it, but he had his hand on the butt of the gun, and he's looking at both of us like, "What did either one of y'all just do?" So Mary was sitting to my left, and she realized what had happened, and she began explaining it to us. The ice bucket containing the soda pop had the ice in it had begun melting, and the cans of soda were falling down the ice. That was it. And then it happened again, you know? And so we all began laughing. I mean, it's funny, but not funny. I mean, somebody could have gotten shot over a melting ice cube.
Yeah.
But this was a teaching moment. The learning would come later. This was a teaching moment. The teaching was this: all because some foreign, and underscore, highlight, circle the word foreign, entity of which we were ignorant, had entered into our conversation, our little comfort zone via the noise that it made, we all became fearful of one another. Ignorance breeds fear. We fear those things we don't understand. And if that fear is not addressed and not kept in check, that fear will escalate into hatred, because we hate the things that frighten us. If we don't address that hatred and keep that in check, that in turn will escalate into destruction. We want to destroy the things that we hate. Why? Because they frighten us. But guess what? At the end of the day, they may have been harmless and we were simply ignorant. So we saw that whole chain almost unravel to completion.
Did you guys talk about that?
Right? Oh, we did later. Yeah.
We did later.
Yeah.
We did later.
Yeah. I mean, we laughed for a while, you know, about it in the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, we carried on with this conversation, and, I thanked Mr. Kelly at the end of the interview. We shook hands. He gave me his card, very similar card to the one that his member had shown me in the Silver Dollar, you know, a few years prior.
Yeah.
I would continue talking with them. I would also interview other Klan people around the country, up north, down south, Midwest, West. So he opened up doors for me within his own group. But I would seek out other groups as well. And, you know, here's one thing that I learned. You know, I've been between traveling as a child with my parents and now traveling as an adult musician or lecturer overseas again, I have been to 61 countries on 6 continents. I have performed in all 50 states. So what that means is I've been exposed to a wide variety of cultures, ethnicities, religions, colors of skin, ideologies, belief systems, all that. And all of that has helped impact who I am. And the one thing that I've noticed, that I've gathered and learned from this, all this travel, is that wherever I go, be it in this country or be it all the way around the world, anybody I meet who even may not look like me, may not speak my language, doesn't worship as I do or whatnot, they all are human beings. And as such, everybody wants these five core values in their lives. Everybody wants to be loved. Everybody wants to be respected. Everybody wants to be heard. Everybody wants to be treated fairly. And everybody basically wants the same things for their family as we want for our family. And if we can learn to apply those five core values, or any of those five values, when we find ourselves in an adversarial situation or in a society or culture in which we are unfamiliar or uncomfortable, I can guarantee you that the navigation will be much more positive and much more smooth.
Have you met with, or do you bump into, whether it's Klans people or other white supremacist groups that they don't necessarily hate you, but they want nothing to do with you? They're separatists. Yes. They don't, hey, you're fine. You're over there. I'm fine. I'm over here.
Yeah.
I won't go over there. You don't come over here.
Right. You have different degrees.
Yeah.
Okay. You have white separatists. You have white supremacists. A white separatist believes, blacks should have their own neighborhoods, their own schools, their own workplaces. Whites, should have their own, and we don't cross.
Right.
A white supremacist is, no, this is an all-white country. Everybody else who's non-white needs to get the hell out of here.
Yeah.
Crazy stuff. But anyway, back to Roger Kelly. I began, I would have Roger Kelly come down to my house, sit right here in my living room. We would sit here at my dining room table, have lunch, have dinner. But now this went on for a couple of years. And, whenever I was up, in his county or whatever, I'd call him. I'd say, hey, man, what are you doing? If he said nothing, I said, well, come run this errand with me. He'd say, okay, I'll meet you wherever. He always wanted to meet me somewhere. He didn't want me to come to his house. Yeah. So this went on for a couple of years. After the first year, Roger Kelly, the Grand Dragon, would come to my house by himself. He trusted me that much that he did not bring his Nighthawk, right? And then, so that went on for a year. So after 2 years, Roger Kelly became the Imperial Wizard, national leader. And then he began inviting me to his home. And I'd go there. He'd show me his Klan den where he'd have his meetings. I'd take some pictures.
When you think, I don't know, is he still alive?
Yeah.
So did he become your friend?
Yes, he did.
And do you think he would respond? If I asked him that question, assuming he'd speak to me, would he say, yeah, Daryl Davis is my friend?
Yes, he probably would. Most likely, yeah. But he's very reclusive now. He used to come out and do interviews, he himself, and do all that. But then he ended up getting fired from every job he had because
he's a member of the Klan.
Yeah, exactly, even though he was ex.
Yeah. In at least some instances, your relationship became one not of necessarily just learning from them, but there was a relationship built.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Go ahead. You start off this far apart, right? At opposite ends of the spectrum. Your enemies, you have nothing in common, or so you think. You talk for 5 minutes, you find you have some things in common.
Yeah.
And the gap narrows a little bit.
Well, but what isn't there a difference here? Like you didn't walk into those situations thinking of them as the enemy. Maybe you did. But
initially, I did.
But they walked in thinking of you as the enemy.
Initially, I did, because I was not set out to. I was not setting out to convert them.
Yeah.
These people hate me, so they are the enemy.
Yeah.
Okay. All I want to know is why are you my enemy with no reason?
Right.
The only reason you have is the color of my skin.
Yeah.
I need to understand that. So yes, I viewed them as the enemy, but I viewed them as an enemy I want to sit down and talk to and get to know.
And so, okay, so the press and, you know, whoever speaks about it and talks about you having, quote, converted them. So we spoke about that. That's not your way of thinking about it.
Right.
So what was when they speak about, when the people who left the Klan, when they speak about why they left the Klan, what do they say? What do they, like, you know, why did they do that? Did they feel like they were insulting you? Was it about you?
No,
their own realizations? What?
Both. That through coming to know me, you know, they figured they had no reason to hate, you know, and they got to meet other people through me. They got to meet, you know, and initially I would only allow them to meet me because I wanted to protect, you know, I didn't know, I would never put anybody else in danger.
Sure.
Okay. Once I got to a point where I trusted them that, you know, there isn't going to be any kind of danger, I would introduce them to other of my Black friends, my Jewish friends, my other white friends who look just like them, but didn't believe the way they believe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So then, because this can happen if you don't do that. Oh, you know, Daryl's okay for a Black guy. It's all those other Black people.
Exactly.
You know, that was you don't want that to happen.
You're the special case, right?
Right.
Oh, yeah, most Black people are X, Y, Z, but Daryl's cool.
Right, right. Yeah. He's almost one of us.
Yes,
yeah, that exactly. kind of crazy stuff, right?
Right.
Okay,
yeah.
So anyway, you know, Roger and I would become friends.
Yeah.
And, you know, eventually he began inviting me to, you know, we go out and have dinner together. I go to his house, he go to my house. He invited me to Klan rallies.
I was going to say that was the most interesting thing. Is
now
that suddenly here, you had a Klan
here
rally.
Here is a. I've been doing this for almost 40 years.
Yeah,
this is 29 years ago, here in Maryland, at one of Roger Kelly's rallies. Okay, you see, I'm a little younger there. here is a.
Everybody was cool with you being there.
Listen, there's a chain of command. If the leader, the Grand Dragon, or the Imperial Wizard says it's okay, whether it's okay with you or not, you obey.
Got it.
Okay, so, definitely there are people there who were not cool with me.
Yeah.
But they had no choice but to be cool to me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so here is, that was 29 years ago. Here's one 7 years ago in Missouri. Different Klan group. Okay? And again, this is towards the end of the rally. At the end of the rally, they have like a picnic table or some setup where you have burgers and hot dogs and beverages. So they leave some people there, you know, by the cross because the cross is going to topple over and they don't want it to fall and set something on fire. So they're guarding the cross. But there are other Klan members off to the side out of view.
Yeah.
Now, what do I do at Klan? Like I said, this one is out in Missouri. What do I do at these things? I converse. Because I'm a firm believer that a missed opportunity for dialogue is a missed opportunity for conflict resolution. So here I am doing what I do. I'm talking, all right? Now, you see the guy that I'm talking to, facing him with the mask and the green cross on.
Yeah.
All right, he threatened me. He threatened me when I came on that rally ground. To this day, for the last 7 years, I get a Christmas present from him every year. He's no longer involved. He is my friend. Okay. Now, the guy that you see right on the other side of me.
Guy with the beard,
That was the Imperial Wizard for that particular group. He and I were becoming very good friends. He had the largest Klan group in the country at the time. And if he had lived, he would be out of the Klan by now. He and I were becoming that close. However, he was murdered. What are you talking about?
Like, what, you're at these Klan rallies. What's the conversation about? Is it about the food?
Everything.
Is it about
everything? Everything. How can you hate me? You don't even know me. That's what I'm saying to this guy right now. What is the problem you have with me?
Right.
All you see is the color of my skin. But yet we speak the same language. We might even like the same things. But you're not willing to give yourself an opportunity to get to know me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm asking like that. You know. Mm-hmm. All right, now I'm going to show you. I'm going to show you a clip real quick of one of Roger Kelly's rallies that I went to.
Davis is one of the few African Americans you will ever find attending a KKK rally. More than attending, he is welcome.
I got more respect for that black man than I do you white niggers out there.
As friendship transcended the color barrier, listen to Kelly at a Klan rally.
All right, man, hell, I'm back, because I believe in what he stands for and he believes in what I stand for. A lot of times we don't agree with everything, but at least he respects me to sit down and listen to me, and I respect him to sit down and listen to him.
The strange relationship of a KKK wizard and his black buddy. In Washington, I'm Carl Rochelle, CNN Sunday Morning.
Okay, so in that one sentence that Roger Kelly said, you know, a lot of times we don't agree with everything, but at least he'll sit down and he respects me to sit down and listen to me, yes. And I respect him to sit down and listen to him. In that one sentence, he named three of those five core values I gave you. I said, everybody wants to be loved. They want to be respected. They want to be heard. They want to be treated fairly. And they want the same things for their family as we want for ours. He said, I respected him. He said, I listened to him. That means I allowed him to be heard. And because I respected him and allowed him to be heard or listened to him, then he treated me fairly by respecting me and sitting down and listening to me.
Yeah.
That's what he said, right? He named three of those core values. Now, I'm not a racist. I'm not a separatist, a nationalist, a supremacist, or any of those things. You know, I don't buy into that. But I listened to him. I showed him that respect. And in turn, he reciprocated. And every time we would get together, I would show him that respect. I would listen. All right. And he would treat me fairly. And over time, it began to work on him. He began to see. His mind began opening up.
And you were not the special case.
No.
Suddenly he's thinking, well, he's realizing he's been mistaken.
Exactly. Okay. And he left the Klan, as did his Grand Dragon. And I have both of their robes.
Yeah.
There they are.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, believe it or not, David, I've had people that I've met, and I've had people that I've not met, who have heard me either on some podcast or on a TED talk or on TV or whatever, and something changed in them, and they email me and ask me if I want their Robin Hood, and next thing you know. It arrives at my P.O. box.
So listen,
I'm really curious.
I have my share of detractors, trust me.
You have your share of detractors?
For sitting down with people like that, absolutely.
We're not talking about racists. We're not talking about Klansmen. We're talking about people who either...
White and black people.
They have a problem with what you are doing, you do.
Yeah, and you know what I do?
You sit down with them and talk to them.
I sit down and talk with them, but they don't get it. And so I pull out those robes and hoods that you saw. And I say, you know, this is what I've done to put a dent in racism.
Yeah.
How many robes and hoods and swastika flags have you collected?
Yeah.
And then they shut up.
Yeah, got it.
You know, when somebody has mistreated you for 400 years, and they're still mistreating you 400 years later, it's time to change your approach. You know, if you do the same thing the same way, you're going to get the same result.
Same result. Yeah.
You know? So, you know, anytime you do something that is not the status quo, you know, you're going to have detractors.
Yeah.
What I'm doing is not the status quo. It should be the status quo. You should sit down with people with whom we disagree and have civil conversations.
Sure.
Okay. You know, Here's the funny thing, David. We as a country, anytime there are two foreign countries that are getting ready to go to battle with each other, or even a single foreign country that's getting ready to have a civil war between two factions, we try to intervene and bring the leaders of each nation or each faction together for a summit, mm-hmm. so that you know things will not erupt. But yet we don't apply that in our own mm-hmm. in our own country. We should clean up our own backyard before we start telling other people what to do.
Have you noticed a change in? Is there more of that now, more of the detractors now than there was 15 years ago? I mean, you're going to be modest about it, but what you've done is extraordinary. That's why people are like, wait, what? They're like, giving him his robes? What? Right. So what you've done is extraordinary and exemplary. And yeah, maybe everybody could do it or should do it or whatever, but are there, so the fact that there are people who are detractors about that, not Nazis, but the opposite side, not Klansmen, but the opposite side.
But I've managed to make supporters out of some of my detractors.
So, oh, that's good. That's good to hear.
But now, let me tell you what's going on today, okay? This country was built on a two-tier society. White supremacy at the top, slavery at the bottom. And as we progress through the decades, we progress like this, right? Mm-hmm. Perhaps like this, but never like this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? When you and I were kids, the black population in this country was 12%. Native Americans, 1%. Hispanic, Latino people, almost 2%. Asian Americans, almost 3%. When we were kids, white people were like 86-87%. Today, the white population of this country is 59%, almost 60%. Black people remain right around 12.9, so they say 13. We really haven't grown, right? Native Americans have not grown. They're still at 1%. Asian Americans have almost doubled. They're almost at 6%, 5.9%. Latino people, Hispanic people have more than quadrupled, 17 point something percent. So if you take just 12% black, 17% Latino, that right there is 29% non-white.
Yeah.
Let alone the other people, So this is happening.
Yeah.
And it is well predicted.
Well, and that's what those people are afraid of.
Exactly. Well, okay.
Browning of America. The
browning of America. White genocide through miscegenation.
Yeah.
And that's what these Nazis and these KKK and alt-right and Proud Boys and other people tell me. They say, Daryl, I don't want my grandkids to be brown. That's the browning of America. When I first started this, almost 40 years ago, there was the Ku Klux Klan, and some neo-Nazi groups, and some white power skinheads. That was pretty much it. Right? Now you got the Ku Klux Klan, the neo-Nazis, the white power skinheads, the alt-right, the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, the Boogaloo Boys, the 3%ers, the 1%ers, the Vanguard, on and on. Right? And they're all saying, Come join us. We're going to take back our country. We're going to make America great again.
Again.
We're going to send those people back to where they belong.
Right.
And so out of fear of their identity being erased, people are running and joining these groups, right? And then when the group fails to take the country back, some of these, or they don't take it back fast enough, some of these people get frustrated and say, if the Klan can't do it or the neo-Nazis can't do it, I'll do it myself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when they go off, solo and walk into a black church and boom, 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 or into the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, boom, mm-hmm. boom, boom, mm-hmm. the grocery store in Buffalo, New York, boom, right, the Walmart in El Paso, the Sikh Indian Temple in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. These people committing these racial murders are called lone wolves. Okay. We have intelligence agencies that have agents, operatives in those agencies that fit the profile of some of these groups, and they can join those groups undercover, gather intelligence, report it back, and squash those plots. Right. So while we may be able to infiltrate some of these groups, how do you infiltrate a lone wolf?
Can't do it.
And as we get closer and closer to 2042, we're going to see more and more of those lone wolves. These people are becoming unhinged. And every time one of them gets shot and killed by law enforcement or gets arrested or whatever, and the law goes and searches their property, what do they find? They find a cache of automatic weapons. That are being stockpiled for what they call Rahowa, R-A-H-O-W-A, which are the first two letters of three words, racial holy war, or for short, the race war. You remember Y2K, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, 1999, everybody was freaking out. It's going to be the end of the world. The banks are going to lose my money. My VCR is not going to stop working.
The water is going to stop. No electricity.
Everything, right? Okay, but the year 2042 is the white supremacist Y2K.
Mm-hmm.
Stop it. You know, so they're trying to stop it.
Are you hopeful?
Yeah, absolutely. Let me say this. I did not support Donald Trump, but I will say that he is the best thing that has happened to this country. He was not the best president. He is the best thing that has happened to this country. Why? Because everything is in your face. The closet door has been opened. The rug has been pulled up. The rock has been turned over.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, people have been in denial. If they don't see it, then it doesn't exist. Oh, you know, we had a black president. We're way beyond racism. No, we're not in a post-racial society.
No, I think that's true. Donald Trump, he did not create it. He revealed it.
But he revealed it and he emboldened it.
Yes, he did. He absolutely did.
And so this is the best time in our country right now. It's in your face. You cannot deny it. Let's address it. Let's get it fixed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's only been in the last couple of years that we began calling these people in our own country terrorists.
Yeah, I love that you asked that question and got your answer. Well, Dale, I really appreciate you giving me the time to have this
conversation.
I hope there's a conversation. Well, I know there will be because we'll see each other on some Friday or another.
But I will be happy to fix you up with some former Klan leaders. I will fix you up with the former head of the largest neo-Nazi organization in this country. It's called the NSM, National Socialist Movement.
Oh yeah.
He's a very, very good friend of mine. And I helped influence him along with a Muslim woman filmmaker to get out of that movement.
I think that is the best piece for me, is that it's not just about collecting robes, and some of the people have become your friends.
Yes, absolutely.
And you theirs.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.